The date today is the 16th of July.
Okay.
And I'm at 619 Bathurst with Dr. Joe Greenberg. Dr. Greenberg bought this building to have his medical clinic and raise his family here in 1956, and it's 2013. But when he was five in 1927, his family moved to 98 Major Street.
Exactly.
So you have lived in this neighborhood for 85, going on 86
of
years.
Course.
Okay. So I just want to say, Joe, thank you very much for giving me this wonderful opportunity and privilege.
Don't, I'm no hero. Don't.
You were just going to tell me a story.
Yeah, I got to tell you the story, but it's cute. Anyhow, when we were very poor those days, but we never realized how poor we were. But I never had any money to go to a show, and the theaters in this area, there was the Playhouse on College Street. And then there was the Garden, which is also on College, close to Spadina, and so I had this money. I think it was either 5 cents or I don't think I had a dime. That was too much, and I don't remember how I got the 5 cents, but who knows. So I told my mom I wanted to go to the show, so she went and took all the remnants of our Shabbos dinner and put it in a brown bag. And then she said to me, she insisted that I see the feature twice. It never occurred to me, you know, why would she ask me to see the feature twice? It's just good, you know, it's happy enough just to go to the show. Why would I question her anymore? So I went, and the first thing you saw was these movie tone news, and then there was the cartoons, and then there was the two reelers, and then they show the feature. So I saw it twice, and I came home. And then later, during the war, I was walking on a street, and I can't remember where it was, and all of a sudden I burst out laughing, you know, laughing, because it was the first time in my life I recognized that my parents had a sex life.
Oh.
And Shabbos was the day. Honest to God, it's really funny.
So she wanted you to see it twice to keep you out of the
of
house
course,
for 3 hours.
Of course, absolutely.
Oh, that's a divine story. And it worked.
About it.
For 5 cents, she could have a good time
of
with
course.
Your father.
Can you imagine that? It never occurred to me. I just burst out laughing. I think if people saw me, they'd think I was nuts. But then I can't remember where it was. It was on some street, not in Toronto. It was maybe overseas. I'm not sure. But it was some street.
So it was like 10 or 15 years later that this light opened in your mind.
For sure, absolutely. I enlisted when I was 18, so it must have been maybe 18 or 19, something like that.
That's very funny.
Isn't that something? So I'm glad you asked me about that.
Well, that means your parents had some very nice things going between them.
I'll tell you something.
Yes.
I had the most marvelous parents. My father was an intellectual. But his problem was that he had TB, and he had it at a very early age. And for that reason, he couldn't serve in the Russian army. And then they made their odyssey from their village. Hang on, I'll just... So in any event, like in my father's town...
Mm-hmm.
First of all, my mother was very special because she captured him. He was a very eligible guy, and he was born in 1880, and I'm trying to think of we came here in 1920, so he was 40 years old. And she was 33 years old. She was 70 years younger than him. And so in my father's town, it's called Obadivka, but in the paper or wherever you're looking, in an atlas or whatever, it's called Obadovka, but I never heard it named that way. It was in the Ukraine, roughly about 100 to 200 kilometers from Odessa. My father told me of Odessa. He says it was the most beautiful city. There was the first city in all of Europe and Asia to have hydro system electrolyzed. Anyhow, so the pogromists came into the town, just like they would in every other town. And when they come to a town, they have to find out where the Jews are. They you know, their intention is to rob them. And so they created some sort of quasi-situation where the Jews were supposed to meet them in the synagogue. So when my father was on his way there with two little girls, my sister Rose, my sister Dorothy, I don't know where my sister Sarah was at the time, they said, no, you've got to go home and take them back, and then you can come back. You didn't come back yourself. And when he heard that, he knew something horrible was going to happen. He was a very brilliant guy and the most modest person you ever met. And so he hid out, and he told my sister Rose, if anybody asks you, tell them that your father's dead. So they herded all the Jews into the shul, and believe it or not, they burned it to the ground. They incinerated the whole gud.
Wow, but your father...
He was away. Yeah. Like, he knew that something horrible was going to happen. And that's how they... And then the
so
next step...
he saved his own life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And my mother... You know, my mother could recite poetry from morning till night, never repeat herself. And don't ask me how or why she had that bent, but she did. And she went and collected all her silver and had it smelted down and into two silver spoons. And that was their Gunsten Vermögen when they came here. I wonder if I've got that. I wonder where it is. I can show you the spoons.
So maybe right after we finish speaking to each other.
I wonder where they are. That's the whole problem.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
And so when they came here, that was it. That was their whole estate. Now, the other things were that there was a fellow called Yeshua Fromstein. He's a relative of ours in some way. I could never find out because I never really asked. We just took it for granted. And he's the one that sent the money, gave the money to one of the travel agents. I think they were Dworkins. And he came over to Europe and to bring everybody back.
He was already in Canada?
No. Oh, like the fellow that gave the money to Dworkin? Like?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He was in Canada, and he sent the money to bring your family
exactly.
to Canada.
So what happened is that When he came to, I think he met them in Romania, where I had an uncle who also was, strangely enough, late years later was killed by Hitler. You know, he had left the Russian army, and escaped from Russia into Romania, and that's where he met his demise when Hitler came to power. So. I don't want to get beyond myself. Anyhow, so he was supposed to have brought everybody over, but he went ahead and used some of that money for himself. And so not all family could go. Now, the ones that remained were included the forebears of Chaim Guri. Now, Chaim Guri is literally the poet laureate of Russia. He's fought in five different wars, and he's a highly regarded educationalist. And as a matter of fact, he was so angry at the British for the way. One of his daughters, actually, or one of his sisters, or one of his aunts, I'm not sure, were the ones that carried the bombs into the King David Hotel.
Oh, my God.
That's true. And anyhow, so there was always some resentment because they couldn't come to Canada, but it was probably the best thing that ever happened.
Could we skip ahead now to
your
life in Toronto in this neighborhood?
Yeah.
Now, your parents bought a house.
98 Major Street.
98 Major in 1927. They had lived in several other homes before that, and you had too.
I thought it cost $3,000. My brother Dave says no, it was $3,500. Well, it doesn't matter. But, and they used to, they had a mortgage from, I can't think of the guy's name right now, but I could, it'll come to me. And so he was very anxious to get his money. So my mother made a deal with him that she owed about $700. And she made a deal with him that if she paid him entirely off, that that would be the end of the mortgage, you know. So she was very, my mother was extraordinary, I don't know how, what word I would use, but so she went to the Hebrew Free Loan, and she borrowed that money and paid off the mortgage. And that was really something.
So your mother was clever.
Oh, it's unbelievably. Yeah. Anyhow, so she paid off the Hebrew Free Loan over the years. You know, it took a long time.
And do you have any idea what brought your parents to Major Street? Why this neighborhood?
Good question. Well, first of all, I told you that I had a sister, Sarah. She was the second oldest, actually the third oldest, because the first child, Rachel, she died in infancy. And so my sister Rose became the oldest, and she was next. And she died at 15 at the Western Hospital. And I remember trying to see her, but in those days the rules were entirely different. They wouldn't let a child in under any circumstances. And just outside on Bathurst Street, the entrance to the Western Hospital was like an inverted V. And I remember sitting there and crying my head off. Now, you'd ask me how I remember these things. Well, if I tell you that I remember being pushed in the baby carriage at Biverdale Park, you better believe it, because it's true. And that memory's gone to pot. Anyhow.
Anyway, so, but you, they wouldn't let you visit your sister.
No, not at all.
She was your older sister or your younger?
She was my second oldest sister.
Your second oldest sister. So she was 15. How old were you at that time?
I was 5 years old.
And they wouldn't let you visit? And
absolutely
you,
not.
And your heart was broken?
Absolutely. I was on the, stayed on the steps and cried my head off. Now, so then they brought my sister to the house on Oxford Street, and they placed her. Well, first of all, a group of women came in and washed her with a great big galvanized pot, you know, or whatever. And then they laid her on this dais that, and covered with sort of purple velvet, you know. And my I remember clearly my mother and her sister, my Mima Bela. What a wonderful
Mima
woman she was.
Mima being aunt.
What a wonderful woman she was. Oh. Anyhow, they were both hitting their head against the wall.
You mean after your sister died?
Yeah, unbelievable. And you know what's happened? And since talking about striking their head against the wall, in 1970, you see that young man right there, the small little gold thing at the front? Is that the shelf?
See? Yes,
okay,
I do.
That's my nephew, Danny. Uh-huh. That's my sister's only child. Uh-huh. And my sister went to Israel or Palestine with her husband Chaim Goldberg. Now they belonged to the Shomer HaTzair, which was the sort of the secular Zionist group, and they had their meetings at our house on Major Street. And I was inside in the summer, the windows were up, and I was cranking up the gramophone. Mm-hmm. And playing classical music. But finally, the Jewish National Fund, Keren Kayamis, told them that they had a plot available for them. So they picked themselves up, the whole group, and they went to Palestine. The interesting thing was that it was 1940. when all these submarines were running wild in the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. But they finally got there, and they started the kibbutz Kfar Menachem. That's our family kibbutz, in a sense. And it's become one of the most prestigious kibbutz in Israel. It's just the most amazing
thing. I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I've heard of it.
They had one of the chalutzim.
Chalutzim mean pioneer.
Yeah, he had a poultry business in the United States, and so they built this big poultry plant, and literally they supplied all the chickens to all the restaurants. You know, became very popular, and my sister was supposed to. She was given a job as a nutritionist. My sister Dorothy Dvorah. Or Donya
on the kibbutz, you
yeah,
mean?
For sure, and it turned out that her job as a nutritionist meant that she was in the kitchen washing the dishes. Anyhow, she thought she didn't like that, so she went and joined the British Army, and she studied nursing, and she actually stood first. In nursing in the British Army.
So lots of smart people in your family. Your parents, you, Mark, this sister.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The thing I'm most proud about is that they're mentioned.
That's yeah. I agree with that. Can we talk about what are some of your early memories of 98?
98 Major Street. Well, first of all, you're looking at a guy that failed kindergarten.
Well, that takes talent.
Anyhow.
What language did you speak at home?
All Yiddish, pretty much.
So did you learn English only when you went to kindergarten?
Of course.
So you went to kindergarten speaking Yiddish, and the teacher couldn't respond.
Well, Fragmir, I don't remember anything like that. I may have started to learn English because I played hooky from William Houston School. And I remember somebody coming to the house and asking me why I hadn't been in school. Anyhow, I hid. But no, I think I must have spoken English to some of the kids on the street. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that. Mm-hmm. That was on Oxford Street. And we moved from Oxford Street to Major Street in 1927. That was the year when my sister died.
Well, so
that's
that
why
a
we moved.
Terrible time for your family. A tragic time for your family.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
But you know what? Maybe I'm ahead of myself now. I was just going to say that it was in some perverse way, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me, because if I considered to be a half decent doctor, it's only because I lived on Major Street and brought up there, because all our shchenim, all our neighbors, were like brothers and sisters, and you got to know them, and you knew immediately when they were not well and what kind of help they needed. It was a whole different.
So
whole
you're
different
saying
existence.
You became a very, you had a community, and you became a very empathic person.
Oh, for sure.
What you're saying, because of the nature of the closeness and caring.
I want to tell you something. We had neighbors next door, and the walls were quite thin, she used to play the radio. She was a Holocaust survivor, and the radio, they had a very popular type of jingle, whatever, Kim Mir Gay in Essen in Friedman's Delicatessen.
They were advertising the delicatessen.
So it was somewhere close to Buffalo. And I remember one time I went to this school and I had a physics exam and I couldn't get started. All I could hear was this thing in my head, Kimmer Gay and Essen. It took me about a half an hour before I could get rid of it and be able to write a line down. And that's the truth.
That's a wonderful story.
It's
true. Just this song ringing in your head.
Oh, my God. It was, and this woman, that was her favorite. Well, the alternative was a Jewish hour, from.
Oh, the Jewish hour on the radio.
Yeah. And she, they played that was the introduction to it. Friedman, Zeller, and Tesla. And I couldn't get started to write anything. I'm lucky I passed the damn exam. I don't. Anyhow, that was it.
You said the word Jewish. Who made up the neighborhood, from what you recall?
Oh, they were practically all Jewish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like, in Montreal, most of the Jews were from Russia.
Yep.
And in Toronto, there were a lot of Russians, but there were many Polish Jews. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in those days, the Russians considered themselves superior to the Poles, and the Poles figured themselves superior to the Golden Sea Hunter. It's all the way.
All pecking order.
I guess so.
The kinds of activities that families did with each other, with their children, what do you recall about that?
Well,
because there was poverty.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
No, the thing is that in other families that had big verandas and stuff like that, Sunday was the day for all the family to get together, always. I can't remember, we didn't have a big veranda at all, and I can't remember, I don't know, I can't remember that same activity at our house.
So you're saying there was a lot of sitting outside on that veranda?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In the afternoon, absolutely. That's where people congregated. Just before my sister left for Palestine, guys in the from Sharm el-Tsair, they used to sit. It was hot. We didn't have any air conditioning. So they sit on the veranda, and the windows were left open, and I was the one that was cranking up the gramophone and playing records, like we used to have records with Caruso and stuff like that,
So music, I walked in today and I asked you to lower the music.
Yeah. I don't play that kind of music anymore.
But it sounds like you've always loved music.
Oh, for sure. My brother Mutt, I want to tell you something about my brother Mutt. I would stack him up against the biggest experts in classical music, and I don't think they could top him. Absolutely not.
So he's an encyclopedia of music.
You talk about operas or anything like that? Unbelievable. And even when he went to Harvard Collegiate, he sang in their operettas. They had great operettas at Harvard Collegiate. They really did. But they don't have them anymore like they used to have. Mostly Gilbert and Sullivan.
That's what they had at that time?
Oh, yeah, Mikado it's really special.
Yeah. What school did you go to?
I just went to Lansdowne School, and then I quit when I was 15. And I thought I used to have a paper route and stuff like that. And then I went to work at the Acme Paper Box.
At 15 years old?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So you didn't finish high school at that time?
I never finished high school. I quit in grade 9.
And you started to work for that paper company?
I was working at the factory. There was a Jewish boss, so to speak. He wasn't part of the people that owned the place. The old boss always owned the Acme Paper Box. And I was getting 10 cents an hour, just doing some manual labor, nothing more than that.
And why did you quit school? Why did you quit school age 15?
Because I wanted to help my parents out. Times were really, very tough, I want you to know that.
Yeah. So you needed to help them pay the bills.
I felt that I may very well have used that as an excuse to go to work. I really don't know, but I do think that's what I did.
And they didn't object.
What is there to object? Something about my parents, they were unbelievable. Like, never asked us who we were going out with, ever. And the only thing they wished for us was good health, nothing more.
So they gave you a lot of respect and trust.
Oh.
That they trusted you.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's some very funny stories that happened there. When I was 16, I belonged to the Jewish Boys Club. That was a phenomenal organization. It was on Simcoe Street. And we had regular meetings. We had meetings with parliamentary procedures, you know. Mm-hmm. It was really special. Anyhow, so they had a dance. They decided on a costume party, something. So this dance was held at 44 St. George Street. That's where the community house is. It was a pretty famous place. Any event, so by that time I had learned to do the two-step, but I couldn't turn around. I couldn't turn corners.
You could do the two-step in, right, but not all directions.
So listen to this. So I got my friend Nady. What's the matter with me?
We can.
It's.
What his last name?
This is what's happening to me. You know, never happened to me before. Anyhow. Nady. Continue.
But Nady was at that dance too.
No, what he did is I told him, please come and see me and teach me
How to do the corners or something.
Yeah. So here we are. So we didn't have any radio then. So we had a couple of popular records. Put them on the gramophone, and he was showing me how to turn the corners. Who comes down? My father comes down the stage, standing in the opening to, we didn't have doors to our front room, standing there, and sees his eldest son.
With his
dancing
arms around.
With another boy. Can you imagine? I wonder what the hell was it, what he was thinking of. But in any event, to his credit, he just watched for a while and went back upstairs. And here I am dancing with another boy. My father comes, and it was Shabbos yet. I want you to know that. You know, I had a bike for my paper route. And I would never take it out of the hall on Shabbos, because then he would know that I was gone to work, you know. So I used to go around the corner and pay 10 cents to borrow some other kid's bicycle.
That was a lot of money to pay to borrow somebody's bike.
That was my profit. So First of all, the star was 2 cents, and then it became 3 cents in 1938 at the Anschluss when Hitler marched into Austria. That I remember clearly.
Your father didn't want you riding your bike on Shabbos.
Absolutely not. Are you kidding?
So, no, but you had to in order to deliver the paper.
Yeah.
So that person really gouged you. 10 cents.
What can I say? It was a kid called Robitoy, Gerald. He was my brother Dave's friend. He was a nice kid, and he didn't come to a very good end. He never had the guidance of proper parents and stuff like that.
But you were working at a young age. How old were you when you were delivering those papers?
I started when I was about 13, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And by 15, you dropped out of school to go work full-time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were very aware of your family's poverty.
I don't know what to say. It was a whole different existence, you know. It's like, I can tell you now, on Major Street, and started college, and I can tell you every single person that lived in every single house, and that's the truth. And I'm not being immodest about it. It's true. And you know, and there was a gang of kids at the south part of Major Street, another gang at the middle part, another gang at the upper part. We're not talking about malicious gangs, you know.
Groups of friends.
Exactly. Always. So.
And the adults did a lot of sitting on the front porch.
Well, I suppose, but I remember we had a rocking chair that my father used to love rocking in it.
In the house or outside?
Outside, on the veranda.
Uh-huh.
And so we were all learning to smoke in those days. So this is a wicker chair. So you run over to the chair, grab a piece of wicker, run around to the backyard, and smoke it.
Pretend to be smoking.
And so my father used to come out and say, he used to ask, what's happening to my chair? We smoked that chair right to the ground. I was ASMR. Those are
wonderful memories. Did your father ever learn what happened to his wicker chair that lost all its wicker?
I'd never tell him. You know, there were times when, you know, when I had to go to cheder after school, and I resented it very much because, you know, the other kids were playing while we were going to cheder, you know. So I used to go to the Talmud Torah on Brunswick, and I used to walk in the front door and out the back door. And so, and when my father, you know, I knew he would find out, so I used to go across the street and stay with my friends, the Katzes. They had a cottage. I don't know how they could accommodate all those people. It was like impossible. And I'd fall asleep there. My father would come at night, pick me up, take me back to my bed.
So you had dinner without those people, the Katzes?
No, we had, this was after dinner. Well, I don't remember. All I know is that I had to go to cheder while the other kids were playing the street.
But you're saying you walked in one door and walked out another door.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
So you could be naughty at times.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about my parents, they were so loving. I don't know what to say. They never asked where we were going or what we were doing or... I don't know what to say. It's just... And the only thing they wish for us, like I told you, is to be well.
So there was
healthy.
An implicit and explicit trust in your family.
Well, I guess so. I suppose so. I never thought of it that way. See, that's social work words.
You dropped out of school at 15.
Yeah.
And you are Dr. Joe Greenberg.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
That's interesting. I'm glad you asked me that question. I had a number of jobs after that. I worked at Columbia Pictures and
in Toronto?
Yeah. And then I was earning at Columbia, I was earning $7 a week. And then my sister Rose, so finally I wanted to earn a few more bucks. So my sister's boyfriend, Ben Aaronworth, he was part of a group that owned a Chesterfield company. So I went to work at the Chesterfield company because the first week there I earned about $22,
wow.
Which was like Canadian, you know. Anyhow, but the point was that I don't know why there was a war on, and with Hitler and whatnot, and so I felt that keenly in some way, and so I applied to the Air Force. And they didn't take me right away because I didn't have enough education for them. Mm-hmm. But I guess finally they got desperate and they called me in.
How old were you?
I was 18.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember going down to this on Bay Street. There was a national club, and that's where they held their admissions and whatnot, or you know. And so so I went there, and well, let me go back a bit. I belonged to a club called Club Imperial. All the kids had clubs.
Yes.
And they all had, you know, and believe it or not, they were really nice kids, you know. And sexual activity, forget it. You know, it just wasn't... It wasn't in our minds or whatever it was. It was altogether different than today. Mm-hmm. And so we had a basketball team, and we had five guys, and we were really very good. And we played in a league that had some intercollegiate players, you know, mm-hmm. and they could never beat us. And the fact that they could never beat us created situations in which we had one guy on our team called Izzy Hoffman, very handsome guy, a really nice person. And if anybody ever told you that he wasn't the sweetest guy, you wouldn't believe it. He had a horrible temper. If somebody dribbled by him, he felt insulted. Anyhow, it was terrible. So one day, we this fight broke out, and the gym was packed. You couldn't throw a ball out of bounds, and the fight started. And finally, the spectators came in. It was fighting like you wouldn't believe. This was what a mob scene. Guys, you know, screaming at each other, and there's one fellow. When I have to pick up a name, it's difficult.
We don't need the names.
Well, the point was, he was a pretty husky guy, and he threw a punch at me.
Oh.
And there's an expression of hearing something just whizzing past your ear.
Yeah.
That's actually what happened. First time in my life I experienced that. And if he'd hit me, you wouldn't be sitting there, and I wouldn't be sitting here either.
So he missed.
Oh, no. So finally the fight was over, okay? When I got home, my mother told me that the Air Force had called, right? And so I went and I enlisted, and I got all my needles and whatnot, you know. This is at Manning Pool, which is part of the Coliseum at the exhibition. And so the next game that I played, the guy said, I was the very first one to enlist, and they said to me, what did you do that for? I said, you know, I'd rather go to war than play with you guys.
Did they see
exactly
the humor?
That's exactly what I told them. Everyone eventually had to go into the service because they started drafting.
So that would have been around 1940. You were 18 years
yeah.
old?
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah, 1940. Yeah.
So you went into the service, but you never finished high school, and you became a doctor.
Yeah.
What's the story?
Let me tell you.
Yes.
I'm glad you're asking me that. Anyhow, so during the war, I had some very prestigious posts, so to speak. I was literally the equivalent of a sergeant major in the Army, right? And so I was attached to a squadron, which was wait a minute, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Hang on. Yeah, okay. Our squadron was number 5 squadron, which was a anti-submarine squadron. Mm-hmm. And we had amphibious aircraft. But I looked after all the ground crew. That was my job. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I noticed mostly is that the officers all the officers had a little certificate from the university, and they were making much more money. So I said, you know, I got to get myself one of those certificates.
To do the same work and earn more money.
Oh, I was doing more than the same.
Just wants to say goodbye. Yes.
Come here, love. So I was determined. So I thought the only way I could get to university would be to be able to get my matriculation. So I thought I would go to a matriculation school.
But this is while you're serving.
Not yet,
oh,
no.
Okay.
Coming to that. See, I jumped ahead a little bit for you. I hope you don't mind. But so what happened is that, So that was my determination. And so when I came home, like this is just after I was discharged. That was another thing. I think our squadron was back in Newfoundland by that time. No, in Gaspé. We came back to Canada, and we got a notice from the government that they were considering discharges, and on the basis of the first in would be the first out. And so naturally, I was in pretty quickly, and so I applied for a discharge, and I got it in about 1 or 2 days. And I thought to myself, what the hell am I going to do now? Who's going to clothe me? Who's going to feed me? You know, it was such a strange feeling. And then something happened that was the biggest compliment I ever had in my life. These guys came up and they said, "You're coming with me. You're coming with us." And they filled their aircraft up with about 1,100 gallons of gas, and they flew me from Gaspé to Montjoly, which is close, which is an Air Force base close to Montreal. And after we landed, they each came and each shook my hand, and they thanked me for everything that I'd done for them. Camping in Tanzania, totally unexpected. I never expected that type of thanks. You know what I mean?
So these are people that had worked with you. Oh, you had been their leader.
Absolutely, and they all thanked me. And these were the air crew and whatnot. Just and more than that, I used to. Any team I ever played for, I was the playing coach. And so any of the teams that our squadron played in, I was their coach. And so they all thanked me.
So you were very modest, obviously.
Oh, more than that. I just couldn't believe it.
Very touched. Anyhow, you're still touched by it when you think about it today.
What a compliment. Anyhow, so... And then I went home. And I...
So that would have been about 1945?
No, it was 1940.
1940. That you were...
No, okay. 45. You're right. I was discharged. The war was over, May the 9th. Anyhow, I remember we were moving our squadron to another water base, which was Gaspé. And I'm trying to think. We went... Well, just let's leave it at that because there are other things that we did. And on the way, I was in charge of the troop train. Mm-hmm. And we went by, we were coming from Yarmouth, that's where it was. And the guys were drinking quite heavily. You know, they would have traded you a bottle of Canadian Club for Pepsi Cola or some damn thing. They didn't have a mixer. And so they were drinking pretty heavily. So and every stop I would have the guys line up and I'd have a roll call and I'd call out their names. And sometimes nobody answered. I said, "Where is he?" They said, "Here, pick him up."
Oh, drunk on the floor.
You know, so I came home, and I told my... And also, my mother was selling bulbs, and she was...
Your mother was selling what?
Bulbs.
Bulbs.
Electrolyte bulbs.
Yeah.
You know, what do you call the long ones?
Fluorescent.
Yeah. Anyhow, and she... She, one of her customers was at the Canadian Jewish Congress on Beverly Street. I want to tell you something. I don't know how my mother did it, but Jesus, they loved her. They just loved her because, you know, if she turned her down or whatnot, she would thank them and just bless them and come back again sometime, you know. Anyhow, so. In her travels, she came across this fellow, Al Purley. And he was more or less made himself the self-appointed person in charge of entitlements and pensions, or whatever it was, you know. And so when she spoke to him and told him that she had a son that had just come home, he says, "You must send him to see me." Well, so anyhow, so when my mother said that, I said, "Ma, I've already made up my mind. It's what I'm going to do." She said, "But Yasala," she says, "I promised." I said, "Ma, you promised that I'm going, and that's all there is to it." And it was the best. That changed my whole life again.
So you spoke to Al Purley, and that you redirected your life because of that conversation.
Oh, absolutely, and I'll tell you why. I went to see him. And he said to me, "Well, what have you done, you know?" I said, "I don't know. I've written some articles for some of the Air Force magazines and stuff like that." So he says, "Well, what do you want to study, you know?" I said, "Well, maybe I'll be a journalist or whatever." I didn't know what the hell I wanted. I didn't know what journalism was. First of all, I could never be a journalist because I can only write when I'm very disturbed about something, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I can write. Anyhow... So he picked up the phone, and he called the Department of Veteran Affairs, and he spoke to Mr. Schulweis and told him that he... Oh, no, hold it, before I get to that. So he sent me across the street to the Federation. You know where there's a Chinese church at the corner of Baldwin and Beverly, but they had the Federation house there. Mm-hmm. It was the Scheuer house, and he was one of the early Jewish German people who came to this country. They had the Jewish vocational service there, and there was a guy in charge of it. His name was Irving Hoffman, and he was a brilliant student, psychology student at the university. He jumped off the board and broke his neck, and he was quadriplegic, but he still had minimal use of his right hand, and he had a nurse with him all the time. So he sat me down and gave me this IQ test. It was a very rudimentary thing, like Stanford, BNA, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing was that all the answers were down the right side of the page, the right edge. So for him to mark it was nothing. He would just take a key of some kind, place it there, and be able to check it off. You know? Mm-hmm. Like he had the right answers. And
yeah.
Anyhow, so he kept looking at me funny, and he sent me back to Al Purdy. Oh, shit. And he told Al Purdy that I had the highest IQ that he'd ever tested. So I said to Al, no, wasn't that? I said, what's the big deal? Who is he testing? Shippers and receivers? What's the big deal? But that was enough to set Al Purdy on fire.
Uh-huh.
And he called this Mr. Scholes at the Department of Veteran Affairs, and Scholes said, listen, Al, I'm sorry, but the school is, you know, for getting your matriculation is all packed. It was all taken up. There's no room there for at least 6 months. By the time Purdy got finished with him, he was such an egotist, but, you know, brilliant guy. I was there at school the next day.
Whoa.
That's the truth. Anyhow, so while I was in school...
That was to finish high school.
Oh, yeah.
High school matriculation.
Absolutely. So while I was there, we were studying senior subjects. So I was going to school from 3 in the afternoon till 10 at night. Mm-hmm. So we were studying one of... And we used to take a chapter a day. I mean, holy mackerel. And each chapter had questions at the bottom, you know. And that's too rapid, but regardless. And so that's another thing. There was a certain synergy in that school that was unbelievable. It was just incredible. First of all, you had teachers who were all retired, principals, vice principals, whatever, and you had students that wanted to go to school. Believe me, you don't find that today.
Yeah,
anyhow,
they were motivated.
Oh my God! So anyway, so I was so this in this in this physics class, the teacher came over. He says, "I see you understand your work, but why don't you reduce your answer?" So I said, "I said I don't know how to add or subtract or multiply or divide. I don't know any algebra." So he says, "So what are you doing here?" And with that, my heart went right into my boots. So I decided that I better study some junior subjects before I start taking senior subjects, you know. So I started going to school from 7 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon to study junior subjects, and then continue from 3 in the afternoon to 10 at night. And you know what? So I was going to school from 7 in the morning till 10 at night. And you know, that was the first time in my life I developed a sort of a love of scholarship. Don't ask me why. I don't know where the hell it came from, but that's true. And so when I was studying algebra or geometry, first of all, I was very good in chemistry and English. But I don't know why, but. And when I was studying algebra and geometry and whatnot, I was the class dunce. No question about it. I'm not trying any. But I had a teacher called John Dale Grand. I owe him everything. And I did find him later, but he was dead. And And he sent me up to the board every time, every day, you know. And everyone used to laugh at me. I didn't mind.
was he being mean, or he was trying to learn?
Obviously, he was trying to get me to learn.
Yeah.
And so, in any event, so I started. So finally, in algebra, I started to understand what was going on with permutations and combinations. I'm telling you now, I was really the class dunce. And so the next step was, I'm coming to what you want, what you asked me. The next step was that they said, listen, boys, we're sorry. There's so many veterans that want to go to university that we're cutting the course from 6 months to 5 months. Can you imagine? Anyhow, so I went to write the first exam in the cafeteria, and cafeteria tables are not examination tables, I'll tell you right now. And while I was studying in the hallway with these long tables, because it was the old normal school that was fashioned after the schools in England, my friend Benny Snyderman came by, and he was the nicest, the sweetest, the handsomest kid you can imagine, short. And we were together in the leaders' corps. I was in the leaders' corps at the Y. They needed guys to help the physical instructor, right? And so they taught us jiu-jitsu and, I don't know, all kinds of stuff. And so so I said, well, where are you going, Benny? He said, I'm going to the office to get some application forms. So I said, so I'll go with you. And so we come into the office at the rehab school, and he asks the girl for application forms for the Faculty of Medicine. So she says, well, what are your subjects? You know, they were so... That's what they were all about, was getting people to go to university. And they didn't have to go to the university to find out what subjects you needed. What they knew everything. So he names off his subjects. Ah, here it comes. I said, Benny, I got the same subjects. Do you think I could get into medicine? Give me those papers. And that was it.
You were just finishing your high school diploma.
I hadn't quite finished it,
So you applied to medical?
Well, people ask me, you know, how did you get into medicine? Like most kids, they grow up, they want to be doctors or firemen or dentists. And I had no idea about that. None, zero. Before I went for a walk with him, in my lifetime, I would never have thought that I would be a doctor. And that's the truth. And that's why when you ask me that question,
wow,
I have to laugh about that. Anyhow, so in the meantime, Benny fell in love with a vet from the Navy, beautiful girl, but he had a sexual relationship with her, in the sense that something like he fell in love with her like Robert Browning fell in love with Elizabeth Barrett, you know, the songs of the Portuguese, and he couldn't be without her one wake moment, not one, and it's just like it took a kid into a candy shop and said, here, you know. Because we never had those kind of sexual engagements or whatever you would call it. So, anyhow, and then the next thing that happened was that I applied for three medical schools. I applied to Western and to Queens and to Toronto Varsity. Western wouldn't have me under any circumstances because they had their charter that you had to be come from the surrounding 13 counties or something like that. Of course, it's changed since then because my son David went to Western. Anyhow, but believe it or not, I was accepted to Queens.
Okay.
And the other thing was that the varsity acceptances were 1 month later.
Mm-hmm.
So they said to me, they wanted me to come. They said, but you have to understand that we want you to reply immediately. And if you don't reply within 3 days, we don't have your acceptance within 3 days, then we will appoint an alternate. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, I got two sick parents at home. Am I crazy? Do I want to go to Kingston? Or, you know, you know what I did? I, you know, got to go back. When they posted the results for the exams, believe it or not, I got first in every subject except algebra. Mm-hmm. And the class was astounded. I mean, they were just astounded, you know. As a matter of fact, going back to that, during the early period, during the junior subjects, I was studying German. And we had a teacher, his name was Broussard, and he was a heel clicker. That bothered me a little bit. But in any event, so before the exam in German, I asked him if I could have some copies of the old exams just to see how the questions were asked. Anyhow, so I wrote the exam, and it wasn't a little difficult. I mean, German Jewish is at least 85% German. Anyhow, so later I went to the office to find out what my marks were, and so the gal in the office, like I told you, they knew everything. She says, I hate to tell you this, but your professor is just here, and he thought you were cheating.
Oh,
he says he's never had a student that studied German for a few weeks and got 100.
Woo.
So, anyhow, so we're going to give you 80. Who gave a damn? Can you imagine something like that? Anyhow, so that's what happened. So in the meantime, here I have an acceptance to Queens, and no acceptance at Western, and I'm waiting for my acceptance at Toronto. And it was a very nervous part of my... I mean, I had a whole month. Like, if I had accepted from Queens, at least I knew it was good. But here, you know, I thought I'd take a chance. Because...
Let's go ahead.
You know, I got to go back a little bit further. So I went to see the principal again. He's a bit of a drunk, but it doesn't matter. I said, "Mr. Bradley, I want to go to university, and if I don't know algebra, there's no point in my going." So he looks up my marks, and he says, "Yeah." He says, "You did very well in all your subjects, and we got a 40 in algebra, and we're going to give you a 50. I said, "Mr. Bradley, thank you, but it's not good enough." So he went ahead and he hired two crack high school teachers to come in for the next month. And by the time we were finished with them, I went to the exam. I was 20 minutes late and I left 20 minutes early. It was a breeze for me. Don't ask me why.
You had learned algebra in a very intense way, but you had learned it.
Yeah. So what happened is that... when I applied to varsity, I had all firsts, you know. So I thought to myself, you know, maybe I'll take a chance. Because there were 2,400 applications, and they only took 200 people. Anyhow, so I took that chance, and fortunately, I was admitted. But that was a very nervous part of me.
I'll bet, because you were giving up your acceptance at Queens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was very nervous about it. But you know what? If it happened today, we had different morals and different ethics in those days. Like, if it happened today, I would have accepted that Queens for sure. And when my acceptance came from the University of Toronto, I would just tell Queens, "I'm not coming.
Yeah,
do me something."
Yeah, yeah. But at that time, you were playing very straight.
That's the way we were.
So you went to medical school straight after high school, in fact.
Well, exactly. Like, yeah. Well, the first two years were pre-meds, mm-hmm. and I was always determined that I wanted to get honors just to prove that I had a bit of a brain episode. I don't know. Anyhow, if we were downstairs, I could show you the results. But in any event, I remember in university, anatomy was the heaviest thing, right? So we had three exams: anatomy and biochemistry and something else. I'm not sure.
Physiology.
No.
Okay,
that
whatever.
Came second.
Yeah, yeah. And how did you do?
Well, I guess I did okay. I mean, so on my way home, I was walking home with Hannah Eisen. She was married to the guy that's the head of the Canadian Jewish News. He's a lawyer, brilliant guy. And she died of a brain tumor. And my mother, the only person my mother ever asked me to go out with was Hannah Eisen. That's the truth. She said, Yossela, why don't you take her for a coffee or something, you know? But I don't know. There was no chemistry there. I don't know. But in any event...
Well, so you went to medical school because your mother wanted you to meet with this
exactly.
particular person.
100%.
And that redirect. But you were willing to work very hard. I mean, you went to school for 15 hours a day to finish your high school from 7 in the morning to 3,
from 3 to
10.
You have to understand that was the first time I experienced the joy of scholarship, I'm telling you right now. I really enjoyed what the hell I was doing.
Yeah.
I never enjoyed it before.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that was it. So... Well, so that's what's happened. And so when you ask me, how do you get into meds? It was like an accident. I mean, my friend Benny Steinerman came by. He said, I'll walk into the office. If he hadn't done that, I might not be sitting here with you. And that's the truth.
Well, I'm not sure whether you'd be sitting here with me, but you wouldn't be Dr. Joe Greenberg.
I guess so.
Who is such a beloved doctor.
And besides, I'm enjoying your company, so don't knock yourself. I tell you. That's something.
The years that you lived in this neighborhood with your family.
Exactly. And I'll tell you something.
Yeah.
That's been the most important part of my career as a physician. I can tell you that right now. I learned to be a doctor because I grew up on Major Street. And I could understand I instinctively knew what was doing with these people. There's no question about it. And, you know... Yeah. And that's true. If I hadn't grown up Major Street, I wouldn't be as adept at practice as I am. 1,000%.
So there was kind of way of relating to people that happened in this neighborhood.
100%, of course.
Yeah, yeah. How would you describe the neighborhood as it was 90 years ago, 60 years ago, 40 years ago?
No,
you've been here for decades.
No, it was like wall-to-wall Jewish, practically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I tell you, I could go, even today, go up and down Major Street, and I'll tell you exactly who every person that lived in every house. That's the way it was. I don't know how to explain it otherwise. Just, and they were all Jewish friends, and we used to play in the streets, and, you know.
What did you play in the streets?
Well, we used to play, we used to have an old football, or, you know, or baseball. We used to go to the... We used to go to the Lansdowne School playground, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know what to say, just... And all the instructors were Jewish, all the...
The teachers at the time?
In playgrounds, absolutely. At Lansdowne and William Houston, and they're all very competitive with each other, too, you know? Oh, it's unbelievable.
The teachers were competitive,
no,
or the children?
The playground supervisors, uh-huh. You know, my God, were they ever competitive? Oh, my God. You know, when it came to the finals, they would get a bunch of, they would get ringers, you know, because it was a 100-pound playground. And they would get other guys to stand in, you know. And it got so bad that the superintendent of the playgrounds had to come down. He weighed everybody himself. It's true, I'm telling you, it's very true. Anyhow.
Can you talk to me? Now, you lived on Major between College and Harvard. But
between Ulster and Harvard.
Between Ulster.
This is Ulster Street right here.
Okay.
Well, you can say between College and Harvard if you like. There's no problem.
Okay. What was happening commercially in that neighborhood? What were the stores? How?
All we had was, for Major Street, we had two grocery stores. We had Mr. Haber, and he was a Galicianer. I don't hold that against him. He was the kindest person And then we had another one across the street. The name just escapes me.
These were corner stores?
Yeah, pretty much.
And did your family do the shopping there?
Oh,
Kensington Market. What about Kensington?
Oh, no, they didn't go to Kensington very much. Mind you, that's not a bad suggestion because my father, I told you, he was an intellectual and a kindest guy. Like, he had a schlachthaus. He had a slaughterhouse on the lane.
Your father had a slaughterhouse?
Yeah.
Where?
It was in a lane between Nassau and Oxford.
So it was south of us, closer to the Toronto Western Hospital.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So that was his business?
Well, that was his forced into us. That was something he never, ever anticipated they would do. My sister Rose, she used to write letters to the editor that were so evocative that it would take your skin off. And she was a very strong supporter of justice in some way, you know. Unbelievable. And anyhow, she arranged for my father to be taken into the Kahila and whatnot. And she came back from Palestine to do that, too.
And so she made Aliyah? Did she live in Israel?
She wanted it. My sister Dorothy, for sure, lived there. And my sister Rose worked there for a very prestigious law firm. And she never went to high school. She learned shorthand on her own. Mm-hmm. She was an amazing, amazing woman. I wish I could. You see, what I'm trying to do is trying to gather everything up, and that would include some of the letters that my sister wrote. You would be absolutely amazed. Her command of English and her thoughts. Unbelievable. And
now, you say that you were very strongly influenced by the feeling that you had on Major Street in terms of the neighbors and the neighborhood and the closeness.
Absolutely. Listen, you could take the boy out of Major Street, but you never take Major Street out of the boy. That's
right.
The truth.
But it had such an influence that it made you the fine doctor that you have been
100%.
For so many years.
I could never be this doctor that I am today without having lived on Major Street. Never, never, never.
But also, you chose to raise your family in this exact same neighborhood, just
move.
A few blocks away.
Let me tell you something else. In the article that was in this article, it's in Canadian Jewish News. Hang on. I'll let you read it later if you like. You want to see what I look like at 18 years old?
Sure.
Would you go
over? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'd run after him for sure. You were 18, and that's when, of course, beautiful. Woo!
I even marvel at it myself. Who was that?
So and that was in the Canadian Jewish News in 2012, I see.
Yeah. So what happened here is that my daughter wrote here, just read this paragraph, just for this.
Greenberg's daughter, Sarah, told the Canadian Jewish News.
Hello? Usher. No, Tusher was his name. He lived on Lippincott Street. And he owed my mother $2. Can you imagine how many chickens that is?
Yeah.
And when she went to see him to collect, he stood there, and he was davening Shemini Esrei. And he kept doubling Shemini Esrei for like a couple of hours. So my mother figured, what the hell? She finally, can you imagine being that insulted?
So your mother was working with your father?
Oh, well, on the week, for just
collection.
Towards.
Uh huh. So he was a shochet, and your mother helped collect whatever was owed to them.
She did it, not really. Well, I'm just giving you that one instance where this fella actually owed her the money and just wouldn't pay,
Yeah.
Can you imagine? It wasn't easy. Anyhow. That was one of my Italian patients. He wants a letter. so he can send his son to, he's going to Columbia University. I don't know how the hell he can afford it. And
oh, so he wants you to write the letter.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I will write it. Yeah, yeah. And, I have to say that this, I delivered this kid, and he had chicken pox. And it was clearly, chicken pox because his sister got it too, so.
But and then, Joe, you chose to raise your family in this neighborhood.
Absolutely.
But the neighborhood changed by that time, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
In what ways?
All the Jews moved north. Take a look what's happening up north in Richmond Hill. And
yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. They've all moved. And
but you knew that this was where you wanted to have your practice and raise your family.
I couldn't care less. Now, I want to tell you that in response to what my daughter asked people to write, there was a letter from a Somali girl. Whether she, how she got to read this thing, I don't know. And she also, she wrote that she got after me to, she used to say to me, listen, you can afford a better place to live. Why haven't you done that? And so I said to her, Edie, it's not the castles, but it's the princes that dwell within. And that's the way I feel about it. Because I shit about the houses. It's the people who live there. And I told her that. And she wrote this letter. She said, I remember you're telling me that.
So it's not the houses, it's the people in the houses.
Absolutely. I said, it's not the castles, but it's the princes that dwell within.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So you felt that this location, the people in this house, the people in this neighborhood, yeah, made it worthwhile. You
well,
wanted this
for thing. Sure, but it's changed remarkably since, you know. But who cares?
And when you raised your children here, what schools did they go to?
That's another thing. I wanted my kids to go to parochial school, mm-hmm, always, and mm-hmm, because I wanted them to feel secure in their religion. I really did. And that was very important to me. And
you sent them to Hebrew day schools?
Always. The kids all went to the Beth Siddiq.
Uh-huh.
And my daughter Sarah and David spent a year in Israel working on the kibbutz. Oh, no. That was,
so their Jewish roots were important for you to make sure that they
When they speak Hebrew, you can never tell them from a
Sabra.
No, never. They are, and they have such a love for Israel, you can't believe it.
And you wanted them to have that.
Of course.
Yeah.
And now she's leading another mission. She's led a few missions.
That's your daughter.
Yeah, and she's leading another one towards the end of this year. And her husband, Ian, he enters their bicycle contest. They ride from I don't know.
I know that there's a long ride that, yeah. I know Rabbi Ed from the Nerivra has done it, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So your son-in-law does that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was important for you to have your children love Israel and be educated.
Oh, absolutely.
Good Hebrew education.
Absolutely. That's what I wanted.
So you lived here, but you wanted them to have that education.
I wanted to be secure in their religion and their feelings towards you too, absolutely.
Could you talk to me for a few minutes, please, about the shul that we all know as Joe Greenberg Shul,
Dr.
and it's
Joe's.
The Sheret Tzedek, right, is the name.
Exactly.
How did that come about?
Well, it's been our shul. Like, I used to go to shul with my father when I was 3 years old. We used to walk to the shuls on Center Avenue. And the Rishon Shul, which is the Eretz Yisrael, was across the street, you know.
Now, where's that? Center Avenue? Because now people think of Center Avenue up in Thornhill. So.
Good for you, and that's where they have that delicatessen.
Right, yeah, yeah. So where's the Center Avenue Shul that you described?
Right. It runs parallel to university.
Uh-huh.
It's one block east of university.
Yes.
And it runs, at one time it used to run north from there to the to the Toronto General Hospital, but they just built in between. And
so that means it was north of Dundas.
No. It was south of Dundas.
Okay.
But there, but it did, the street crossed Dundas, and the rest of it went up to Toronto General.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I was going to school, we used to have a lot of fun. We used to, when they were, they used to raffle off the Elias, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, it was really something. These guys were sort of, you know, trying to match each other, and they were saying that, don't go away.
So they would raffle off the Elias, and people competed against each other.
Kidding?
So it was a real fundraiser.
Are you kidding? They had a, what do you call it? They had an auctioneer. I mean, I'm telling you something, it was such fun to information for our Eskimo, for our Tvetanmo. Finally, for our Tvetanmo, that's when they...
So in shul on Shabbos, they did that?
Absolutely. And it was for the Umtoy mostly.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But it was really, oh God, we used to think, this guy's bidding $25.
Wow.
$30, holy mackerel.
That's a month's salary.
Oh, are you kidding, a month's salary? It was incredible, and so it was a lot of fun for the kids.
So you went to shul at the Center Street Shul as a child.
Yeah, for
okay.
sure.
So shul was part of your life.
Oh yeah, I guess. I don't know.
But then years later, the Shaarei Tzedek is your baby.
That's true.
And you kept it alive when the population moved.
No question about it, because I couldn't. I had a great love for these old timers. And they said, for the old times, that's not true, it's for the old timers.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted that shul to remain in perpetuity.
Okay. So that's on the corner of Markham and Ulster.
Yeah, it's just over here.
That was a shul that existed, and then you became a member? What happened with that?
Oh, we don't have any members. Well, I guess we do have members. Let me explain something to you. That, in truth, there may be 3 or 4% of are the activists that keep the place going.
But you're the one who kept it going, really.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I agree with that. Nobody says no. There are many nights I used to lose sleep. They wonder, you know, I just wanted to make sure that they, you know, we've had some fun in a sense. And we were painting the shul, right? So we had a painter, and we had the donated paint. So we're painting it blue. So we had this Polish painter, so we paint one wall. And we used to look at it, no, that's not it.
Go to a different wall.
Finally, he got the right color and painted the rest of the shul. And also, what I'm going to do now, I'm a bit of a mess in the sense that our Sefer Torahs are well over 100 years old. And so by this time, you know, you can hardly read the Oysis. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ordered another one from a sofer who's writing right here in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for $30,000, which is way... We don't have any due, so to speak. We get our money sort of in Yom Tov, like...
So people pay to go to shul for Rosh Hashanah,
no,
Yom Kippur.
Only our tickets are 50 cents each, which is incredible.
I know, it's nothing.
Yeah, well, we do that because we don't want our tickets to be a means test.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you have these expenses; you're still keeping the building afloat.
But the highest paid employee in our shul is a cleaning woman.
Uh-huh.
And that's the truth.
Yeah, but please tell me what. At what point did you become active there and become determined that this is going to be a viable shul and it's going to be one that's going to last?
I don't know. Quite a while, I guess.
Well, I know that my middle son, who's 44, had his bar mitzvah there.
Is that the one?
Misha Levine.
He's 44 now?
He's 44. He had his bar mitzvah.
Was that long ago?
And he wasn't. And it wasn't a new shul at the time.
No, it's not that. It's just that...
It was beautiful and wonderful.
You know, that I've had that happen a few times. Abe Rothstein, who's...
Uh-huh. No, Abe.
Yeah. Okay. And the shul his son was going to, and he was, and he was singing in the choir. I think it was the, what's the name of the one
in Brunswick?
No, it's up north.
I don't know. There's lots of shuls.
Well, it's one of the Orthodox shuls. No, it's a pretty big shul. Jesus Christ. What's the matter with me? See, if I have to think of something quickly, but
Sher Shemaim?
That's it. Sher Shemaim. Always come to me. Okay. And so they refused to have his bar mitzvah at that shul. Why? Because Abe Rothstein, his wife, was converted by...
not an Orthodox conversion,
exactly.
I guess.
Who were the next step down Orthodox?
Conservative.
Conservative, right. And they wanted her to be reconverted, so to speak.
Oh.
And he said, how the hell can I ask my wife to do that? So he came to our shul and said, listen, we couldn't care less. Just bring your kid. We'll be more than happy to have him. I mean, that's so stupid. This kid was singing in the choir. He sang there for I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. And all of a sudden, when he came out, they turn him down. I thought that was horrible. Absolutely horrible.
I agree.
And,
yeah.
You see, our shul is special in this respect. There's a certain generosity and sweetness in our shul that you won't find anywhere. And if you want to daven, fine. Go up and daven. We don't care. I'm serious about that. What's the big deal?
But you gave so much because as the Jewish population moved north, and we know that it did, you were determined to keep those doors open
absolutely.
While it became more and more quiet
100%,
there.
Absolutely. And you know something?
And it's alive and well again.
Yeah. There people are moving downtown again. And that's true. And we have a meeting where other shoes don't. So,
and do you get there sometimes?
I'm not as active as I was because of all this business. This is interesting. My son David is on the Chazanish staff at the temple. No, what's the temple?
Temple Sinai?
No,
I don't know.
The big holy Boston.
Oh,
and I don't mind that at all. And his wife belongs there. And every year, it becomes more and more traditional.
Yeah.
100%. When I first went there, and they had the organ and the Goyish choir, I said, where am I? And that's the truth. And now if you go there, it's different. It's altogether different.
So it's moving more to the center.
I don't particularly care for the Reform Siddur. Because they chop it up in so many pieces, you know. But the one from the Beth Tzedek, where my son-in-law, Sarah's husband, goes, he changed because he loved that shul, and this fella, was it Spiro or something?
Yeah, I think so.
And he had a marvelous voice, and it was just great. He said he really enjoyed it. And so, I like their siddur. Because
at the Beth Tzedek, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. Because it's, what would you call it? What kind of shul do you call it?
It's conservative.
Yeah, that's fine. They don't chop it up so much that it's not even recognizable, you know? And so he goes there. He switched from the Sher Shemayim to this shul, which is...
So you have your daughter and son-in-law at Beth Tzedek.
Yeah.
And... your son and daughter-in-law at the Holy Blossom.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. And I don't mind at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because as the years have gone by, for certain, there's been a definite trend to traditionalisms at the...
the Holy Blossom.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, it's certainly, there are a lot of us, I mean, I don't go to the Sher Tzedek, but I'm very grateful for what you've done.
Oh.
As I said, my son had his bar mitzvah there, and it's a beautiful, wonderful place.
I was so happy for, you know, somebody to come and ask us. You're crazy, of course. Bring that kid in. You know, what the hell are you talking about here? You know, it's I thought to myself, are these people crazy?
Yeah. Narrow, very narrow.
Oh, I don't know what the hell it is. Yeah. It's ego, too.
Do you... So, in your medical life, you've made a major contribution.
I'm not sure about that. Everybody seems to think so. Yeah. It bothers the hell out of me. Like, they come to my son, David, now, and... They said, you know, he's a very good doctor, but he ain't Joe Greenberg.
Oh.
I hate to hear that, but that's what happens. And I hear that time and time and time again. So what the hell? And also, I think there's a bit of a, what's that Freudian expression? Can't think. What's the matter with you? I have to think something quickly. I'm in trouble.
Oedipal?
Oedipus complex, exactly. There is, it exists. And I feel bad about it, but I can't do a thing about it. I just, obviously he has his own ambitions and...
Well, he's following your footsteps. I mean,
well,
he has a family. He's got three children, I think, and
and they're
practicing medicine.
And his wife's a lovely person. And
yes.
And she belonged to... Her father wasn't much of a Jew in the sense we talk about, you know. Like when his grandson had to be circumcised, so I went there and I took a tallis and I took a kippah and I gave it to him, and I could see that he wasn't too happy, but I didn't care. But he accepted it, you know.
But it is a Jewish family, despite that her father was uncomfortable with it.
Absolutely.
But that young family is a Jewish family. And that means a lot to you, obviously.
And my son's wife is awesome. She's an extraordinary, extraordinary person, I must tell you. She's
Maggie,
so
is that her name?
What?
Is that Maggie?
Margot.
M-A-R-G-O-T. Yeah.
So
yeah,
for her excuse.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And her mother? Phew, it's unbelievable. She's the nicest. She's a Montrealer.
Yes. Oh, I know her because she's Mimi Hollenberg's cousin.
Yeah, Klein.
Yeah. Loewy.
She's very special.
Well, you know, I think I've used plenty of your time.
Frankly, I don't give a shit. I've this girl that's going away. That's what I want her to do is to dictate a letter to her, but she's gone. So that.
Well, Dr. Joe Greenberg.
Yes.
I really appreciate
you. Please,
I hounded you and I haunted you and I begged and I pleaded and you finally let me come. Thank you.
You said you seduced me. What else can I do?
Well, Joe, thank you very much.
Don't
it's been
be
a
like
pleasure.
That. Honest to God, it's been a pleasure. I swear to you, I'm happy to have you. And I don't know what to say. I've got a million articles, a million pictures. So what the hell good is it?
Okay, well, we can talk. I'm going to turn this off and we can talk about pictures, but Joe Greenberg, thank you very much.
Bye, please. Corner of Ulster and Major.
Uh-huh. Mrs. Schulman, yeah.
So I used to clean her sidewalk, but this one time it wasn't snow, it was pure ice. So I had to get a chopper. It took me about 4 hours.
Oh, my God.
And she gave me three cents.
Wow. She wasn't one of the more generous tippers.
No, it's not that she wasn't generous. That was what people pick.
But what you're saying is you have a lot of stories.
I have a Canadian horror, too.
I just want to say, if ever you want to talk to me again, I would be delighted to come because we...
I would. You know, I'm having problems with this business. Like, when I was younger... And if I knew I left something for the future, there was a future. But when you're 91, it's not the same. And that sort of bothered me a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
My brother Dave is bothered by the image of being placed in the ground and the worms crawling over him, you know. I don't have those kind of images. And I want you to know, my brother Dave is a very intelligent guy, a highly respected person, I'll tell you.